pray. Amen. So tonight we reach towards the end of Job. And once we get to the end of Job, now God will be able to speak. He's been mostly silent through this. We know that we heard from him in chapters 1 and 2 in the heavenly council when the Lord spoke to Satan and with the heavenly council. And then he's been quiet ever since. But we know that he's not been unaware. We know that he's not been not present. We know that he's been there. But tonight he is now going to speak. And so we're going to kind of slow down tonight. And we're actually not going to get through the chapter 38. It's going to break a little bit before that. But I want us to really just consider God's words here. Because as I prayed, we've talked about suffering through this. When our life does fall apart, what are we to do? And it can cause us to do some of the things that the friends do. It can cause us to do what Job has done. But tonight, I just pray that what God says will really get into our hearts and remind us who's really in charge here. I told Pastor Brian, I said, you know, there's a lot of times that this happens where the Sunday morning message and the Sunday night can just link up. And I think this is another one of those times where it can just really link up. You can be in two completely different places in Scripture, sometimes in different testaments, but they can really line up. But at least right now we're both in Old Testament, but I think we're going to see a lot of what Pastor Brian talked about in this passage tonight. So in chapter 38, we've heard from all the other men, but now we're going to hear from the Lord. And so I want you to look at verse 1 of chapter 38 and look at what it says. It says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." So if you remember, so number one, we had the voice of God, the voice of God. And then letter A, we have now the event itself. So notice what we're told here. We're told that the Lord answered Job. And so this is the thing that Job has been crying out for, right? God, speak. Let me speak to you. Let me go before you. Let me plead my innocence. Find me blameless. Like, that's the thing that he's been asking for, is let me go to God, or let there be a mediator who will speak to God on my behalf. And this is the thing that he's been crying out for. It's also the thing that terrified him, because he understood just anybody can't go before God, but he always held on to what? I'm righteous, or I'm upright, I'm blameless, I'm innocent, so therefore let me go to God and he'll vindicate me. And that's what he's been calling for. But what's happened here now? Now the Lord's coming to him. The Lord is answering him. And so now it's going to be God who's going to speak to him. And we don't know if this was audible. We don't know if he was literally hearing God speak to him, or if it was in his spirit, an inward voice that God was speaking to him. We don't know exactly what it is. But what we do see is how this happened. Notice it said that he answered Job out of the whirlwind. And if you remember in the previous chapter, that was exactly what Elihu used to describe God working metaphorically, was through storms, right? That was what Elihu had used as an example of, hey, the storms are God speaking. And now it's like exactly what Elihu described metaphorically, now God is doing physically and literally. There's a whirlwind that comes up, and it's through that that God speaks. And this was no doubt to show his power and remind Job who is speaking. This just the whirlwind itself should cause Job to kind of be like, whoa, what is going on? And then for God to speak through that. So there's the voice of God here. And so letter A was the event, but letter B, notice the name, the name. Notice in verse 1 again, then the Lord, all caps, Lord, answered him. Whenever we see that in the Old Testament, we know that that's the name of God. That's the covenant name, Yahweh. And that name has not been used since the first two chapters of Job. In the heavenly council scenes in chapter 1 and 2, he is called Lord, the covenant name of Yahweh. But then all the way from the end of chapter 2 all the way up until chapter 37, it's only God, Elohim. But here now, it's shown that he is addressed as God in the text. It says, then the Lord answered him. So Yahweh answered him. Now, remember, we have to remember our timeline here. This is all happening pre-Abraham, maybe contemporary of Abraham. So Job wouldn't have known the name Yahweh, because that doesn't really get revealed until Moses, Exodus, going up to the mountain, and he reveals himself as Yahweh. So the meaning of this wouldn't be revealed until much later, but what we see is in this, what we should see out of this is that he's the Lord Yahweh who has a covenant with his people. So he's addressing Job not as this big, mean, ugly, scary God, but rather is Yahweh, who loves him and cares for him, the covenant name. So even though this whole event can seem scary, it can seem sarcastic, it can seem, I'm going to show you who I am, understand that it's all coming from love of a good covenant God, Yahweh. And so what really encouraged me when I was studying for this and preparing for this is that it's just another reminder that Job is a picture of God loving and seeking out his people, whether they're a Hebrew or a Gentile. Just because he's not part of the Abraham line doesn't mean that God wasn't searching out his own people and making covenant with them and loving them and caring for them. So this is still the same Yahweh that will redeem his people through the sacrifice of Christ for them. So that's encouraging to me, and I hope it's encouraging to you to see that God still has one plan for one people, whether they be Jew or Gentile. And so that, if nothing else, I hope that Job is an encouragement for that. I know that was a big takeaway for me, something I just never really studied and never really thought about in that way until I really dug into it. So now, that's the event of what's happening. Now let's get into what he actually says. Look at verse 2. He says, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. So now number 2, the knowledge of God. The knowledge of God. So here, the Lord begins with this challenging question. And in all of his speeches, he will begin this way to set a main subject. So this is kind of how we know, okay, this is kind of the first part of his speech, is because he asks this question, this challenge here. And notice he says, who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And it's that word counsel that's the important word, because what counsel is the plan or design by the Lord by which he governs and operates the world. We could easily say, just like Pastor Brian talked about this morning, his providence. So his providence, the meticulous way that he controls and operates and uses the plans and that he uses his purposes for his plans through the world, through history, through time, through people. And so that's what the counsel is. So the counsel is how God works, the knowledge that he has, the power that he has, the sovereignty that he has, how he operates and governs his world. And so this is important because notice what he says. Who is this that darkens, and we could replace the word, who is this that darkens the providence and power and purposes of God by words without knowledge? And so what he's saying is while the friends have set this up as, we know how God operates. If you're suffering, that means you're wicked. And Job, you're suffering, so that means you're wicked, right? Because only wicked people suffer. And that's just the way the world works. God will punish wicked people, and they will suffer. So if you're suffering, then you're wicked, right? That's been their whole premise. And they were wrong, right? We know that. We know Job is upright and blameless. He didn't do anything. He didn't sin to cause this, right? We actually know that it was his righteousness that caused God to say, have you considered my servant Job, who is upright and blameless, right? So we know the friends' charges against Job are wrong. They're incorrect. They're baseless. They're false. And he's vindicated from that. However, God now confronts Job and says that Job has said things about God and how he works that are not true. Job's claims of being blameless are true. The problem is he misspoke about God. He's speaking, notice what the Lord says, you're speaking without knowledge. Job claimed things about God that were not true. And that's what God is now confronting him about. He says, you've been speaking about things like you're an expert that you really don't know anything about. And that's not good. You're upright, you're blameless, yes, but you have spoken without knowledge. Essentially, Job has been judging God based on the things that he would do if he were God. And that's where we can always go sideways. When we think we can tell God, oh, here's what you should do. Or here's what you should have done. And that's the kind of thing that Job has been doing. And this is the same thing that Elihu had said about Job. He says that he spoke without knowledge. And so now the Lord is going to Job and he's saying, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge, dress for action like a man? Essentially what God is saying here to Job is he's saying, put your big boy pants on because we're about to get to business. If we wanted to put it in modern vernacular. But again, he's not doing it sarcastically, but he's saying, suit up because we got business to take care of. Notice he says, I will question you and you make it known to me. So it's just like a lawyer that's looking at him and saying, I will ask the questions and you will answer me. A little irony here. God asks lots of questions. Job doesn't get a chance to answer. Or, I should take that back, they're rhetorical. God's not looking for an answer. But he says, I will ask the questions. So we need to understand that, yes, God is being direct with him, but we always have to remember that it's the Lord, it's Yahweh that's saying this. He's doing this for Job's good, but he still has to address his character. And so now God's going to begin his response by looking at the created order, which is a topic that we have seen throughout Job. They love to use the illustrations from the created order. So just as the friends had done, just as Job had done, just as Elihu had done, now God, the creator of the created order, is going to do the same thing. But he's going to get it right when all the others had spoken in many ways that were so wrong. Look at verse 4. He says, so where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So now, number three, we have the order of God. The order of God. And letter A, we have creation's design. So now the Lord begins this with the illustration of creation, but looking at it as a building project. He begins with the foundation. Notice verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Before you build a house, you got to lay the foundation. Tell me if you have understanding. If you know something that I don't know. And of course, we know that God searches minds, he knows hearts, right? So God's not saying, tell me if you know this, Job. He knows Job. These are all rhetorical. So he says, where were you when I laid the foundation? Who determined its measurements? Of course, the answer is God. Or who stretched out the line upon it? Who made sure it was square? Who made sure that everything was laid exactly where it needed to be? Or what were its, on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. That morning stars and sons of God is illustrating the angels who would have sang for joy at creation. Who looked at everything and rejoiced in what God had created. And so what the Lord is asking here is, he's saying, did you have a hand in any of this? Not only did you have a hand, but do you understand it? Do you know? Did I ask for your input? God was not only doing the construction himself, but he was the chief architect, the designer, the surveyor, and the builder. He did it all. He designed it all. He planned it all. The work was completely by his wisdom, his power, and according to his purpose. And God had an order and a design for it all. And that's why we can see a system in it, right? I talked about this a little bit last week, so I won't belabor it. But we can see a system in creation because God designed it that way. It's not random. It's not arbitrary. And of course, science says, oh, look at the system. But really, we should see the designer behind the system. The one who controls it all. The one who created it all. And so that's why in Genesis 1 and 2, when you read through creation, you see how he had an order and how he did everything. And then at the end of each day, what was it? It was called what? Good. It was good. Creation was good. And it was all by God's speech. He spoke it. There was no error in it. He didn't have to correct anything. He didn't have to erase anything. God didn't have to measure twice and cut once. He just spoke and it was the way that he wanted it to be. From the very beginning. And that's why in verse 7, the angels sang and shouted for joy because they saw, wow, look at what he has created. And they were amazed by it. And so now he's asking Job to challenge Job. Why do you think you can tell me that you know better? Why do you think you can say how I should have done things? Is this your world, Job? When you're speaking about things that you had no part in, nor do you have the wisdom to even comprehend it. And see, the way I kind of think about it is just the end of last year, we went out to the Grand Canyon. And you can see pictures of it, but until you stand there and just look out, like, pictures don't do it justice. And I can, you know, you can read about when they, how old they think that was and how much time it took. And you can see what they're describing. But that was, you know, 30 million years ago or whatever. I'm like, you know, got problems with your math there, but this isn't about that. If I look at that and I'm just amazed by the creation of it, imagine sitting there saying, all right, God, you put the river there. What about just putting the river over there? Why'd you put the river there? Why? It needs to be over there. We would think that was silly, right? Like if I prayed and said, God, you put the river in the wrong place. And we'd say, how silly is that, that you're like worried about that and you're fretting about that? But then why in our own life do we say, God, you shouldn't have gave me XYZ? Or God, you shouldn't have given my mother cancer, or my daughter shouldn't have Crohn's. Like, we can look at creation and say, well, it'd be silly to sit here and complain about where this river is or where this land is or where that is. And we would say, man, or that's the mountains or whatever. And we'd say, that's ridiculous. But the very same God who designed that works in our life and has a power and purpose in what he's doing in each of our lives. And I think that's what the Lord is starting here. And he wants to teach him a valuable lesson of exactly who is in charge. Does God care for our suffering? Absolutely. But we need to understand that we don't have access to the wisdom that he has and therefore the purpose that he has. And that's where he's starting. He's starting with, hey, I've got this whole design. Where were you? Where were you? You don't have the knowledge that I have. And so that's the first thing we see here. But look at verse 8. He's nowhere near done. Look at verse 8. He says, or who shut in the sea with the doors when it burst from its womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. So let her be. We have creation's power. So now he turns from the creation or the design of creation to now the power of creation. Notice he turns to the sea. And we've seen in Job over and over that the sea, the water, is a place of chaos, of fear, of darkness, of terror. It was a scary place for them, right? We know that they had views on that. And so they thought that's where Leviathan was. That's where they thought the dead were underneath it. And so these were common themes of that. But now God returns to that. And he says what? Who has complete control over the sea? Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? And I prescribed, verse 10, and I prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no further. So here we see who is controlling the chaos. If we think about the sea as darkness and terror and chaos, he says, who controls that? The thing that you're most terrified from, I'm the one who set the limits on it. I'm the one who has said you can't go any further. So even the thing that you're most terrified about, God says, who controls even that? And it obeys. He says, I created the boundaries for it, and it can go no further. Which caused me a little bit of, not really a deep dive, but I was just like, I should know this from my schooling, but I had to look it up. You may know this, so I'm probably behind. But I just lost track, really, of the scale of the world. So maybe you knew this, but 71% of the earth surface is water. 71% of the earth's surface is water. That means land is only 29%. Almost 3 to 1. Almost. And get this, if 71% of the earth's surface is water, more than 80% of the ocean has not been mapped, explored, or seen by humans. That's how massive the oceans are. And it's really just one ocean, right? We know that. And God controls it all. He keeps it. Like, all he's got to do is, like, just turn his head, and the water would just flood us all, right? Obviously, that's not what he does. But I'm saying, if he just lost control for one moment and just let the waters go, they would flood us all and wipe us all out. It would be just like Noah all over again. And so I love when you think about that. Notice what it says. Verse 8 again. Who shut in the sea with the doors? And he prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. He says, it's Yahweh who set the limits here. The thing that you're most terrified of, God's holding it all in place. And it obeys. It's all in my hands. He says, I'm not working according to your purpose, Job. I'm working according to mine. And I have the power over that. But not only that, look at verse 12. I think this is kind of a natural. So if we think about the sea as chaos, as terror, then look at verse 12. He says, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It has changed the clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. So now let her see the limits of evil. If God controls the chaos and the evil and the terror of the sea, now he's going to give the limits of evil. And so with Yahweh's power and purpose in creation, he now explains how the wicked are limited within creation. So he goes from this idea of construction and building to now an idea of an army general or commander. Notice what he asks. He says in verse 12 again, have you commanded the morning since your days begin and caused the dawn to know its place? That word commanded there is like a general ordering you. And when a general speaks, Dusty knows this, right? When a general speaks, you got to do it, right? And that's what he's talking about here. He says, have you commanded, have you ordered the sun to rise? Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Saying, since the day of you been born, does the new day start on your command? And you caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth. It says, can a day not start until you say so? And of course, the answer to that is no. But notice, not only that, notice it says, and the wicked be shaken out of it. What does that mean? What he's talking about is this idea of, if you have a tablecloth that has crumbs on it and you take that off, before you wash it, you don't wash it with the crumbs all in it. What do? You take the tablecloth and you shake it in the trash can or whatever, shake it on the floor and then sweep it up if it's just loose crumbs. But you shake the crumbs off, right? And then you wash the tablecloth or either you put it away. He says, when God starts a new day, he shakes the tablecloth and he says, the wicked be shaken out of it. Why is that? Well, we know from scripture and we know from just life that wicked, evil deeds are usually done at night because that's when they're not seen. Things happen in broad daylight, but typically things happen at night. And so what Yahweh is saying here is he's saying, when a new day comes, we shake out the wicked. We shake out the things that have been done in the darkness. So that what? Verse 15. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. So he's kind of got this different illustration here, this idea of a commander who begins the day, causes the sun to rise, because then darkness has nowhere to hide. So think of what we just talked about with the sea, the place of chaos. He says, I have set the boundaries of as far as it can go, right? It can't go any further than I say. Now he says, I'm the one who brings light into darkness so that the wicked, their light is withheld and their uplifted arm is broken. He says, I have control over even what the wicked do. They can only do what I allow them to do. He says, their plans won't continue apart from me allowing them to. And one day, that will all ultimately come to an end when Jesus returns. Then there will be no more darkness. There'll be no more evil. There'll be no more wickedness. But what he's showing Job here in this, is he says, look, there might be evil and there might be suffering in the world, but I'm sovereign over it. Nothing can happen apart from me. And when the time comes for me to dust off the tablecloth and put that into the trash, I'll do it. But it's according to my purpose and my plans and my wisdom. He says, Job, you can't even command the sun to rise. Why do you think you know what I know? And so we have to remember that while we can see evil and wickedness around us, that does not mean that God is not in control or that he's not working. Because that was part of Job's whole argument, right? It's like, I am innocent, I am suffering, God, you can't let this continue. And God says, I have a purpose and a plan. Because it was Satan's working. There was the storm that came from Satan. There was that caused the house to fall down. There were the marauders and the bandits that came in and killed the servants and stole all the livestock. Like, all that's evil and wickedness. And God's reminding Job, hey, I was sovereign over that. I allowed that. But I know things that you don't, and I have power that you don't. None of it takes him by surprise. He doesn't have to react to it. It's all under his sovereign knowledge and wisdom and control. Now, the natural question that we should have is, how do we know that for sure? Is it possible that there's something out there lurking that could attack that God doesn't know? Well, luckily, that's what he addresses next. Look at verse 16. He says, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. So letter D now, in the depths. In the depths. So now he takes Job to the deepest, darkest place that was known to them, which was the realm of the dead, the place of the dead. And so just as Yahweh says, hey, I have complete control over the sea, he says, even the place, the deepest, darkest, scariest place away from man, he says, have you ever been there? Do you even know what it looks like? Have you journeyed through that? Have you traversed it? And of course, the answer to that is what? No. Because if you went there, you weren't coming back, right? Only the dead went there. And so he says, have you seen that place of terror and fear and darkness? And the answer is no. He wouldn't be standing right there if he was dead. He wouldn't be there. And so what he is showing him is, look, even the place that you've never seen, the furthest away from man, right? There's living earth and then there's the realm of the dead. He says, even that place, the farthest away from you, I know where it is. I know what's going on. I know who's there because I created it. And I know it. And there's nowhere. David said this, right? He said, even if I go down to Sheol, you're there. Because he's telling him, there's nowhere you can go that I don't see and I don't know. He has knowledge about it. Job, you don't know about that. You've spoken as if you know things. And Yahweh's showing him, you don't really know, Job. You don't really know. And so there's nothing that's hidden from his sight or from his knowledge. But not only does he know about it, everything happens under his control. Look at verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the path to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. So now letter E, directing light and darkness. So now he asks him this, thinking about if light and darkness have a home, a physical home. That's the picture here that he's posing to him. As if the moon and the sun are like clocking in. You know, okay, my day's done. Have a great day. I'm done for the day. Okay, I'm going home. All right, y'all have a good night. You know, it's kind of that idea is what he's picturing here, what he's kind of illustrating. Of course, metaphorically. But what he's talking about here is his control over goodness and evil, over order and chaos, over joy and sorrow. And notice, we have that picture of them kind of going in and out of a location, clocking in, clocking out, checking in, checking out. But notice what he says in verse 19, he says, where is the way to the dwelling place that you may take it, verse 20, that you may take it to its territory? This idea here is like a conductor. Are you conducting them? Are you calling the light in? Are you calling the darkness in? Are you telling the light to leave? Are you telling the darkness to leave? And of course, the answer is no. You don't have any of that kind of power. But again, he's showing him, hey, not only is there evil, but he says, I'm moving the good. I'm moving the evil according to my purposes. Exactly what Pastor Brian talked about this morning. God is not directly causing the evil, but he can take the evil plans of people and turn them for good or for judgment. And that's the hard part for us. Isn't it? Let's just be honest. Like, isn't there a part of the Joseph story that just doesn't seem fair? Humanly speaking, right? Isn't there part of that? It's just like, all right, why did Joseph have to be sold into slavery? Why couldn't God just get him to Egypt without that terrible turmoil? But that's exactly what God's trying to get Job to see here. If there was a better way, God would have done it. It's what had to happen. And so here he has this idea of, I can bring the light in. I can bring the darkness in. I can send them out. He says, I'm directing all of that. And sometimes it doesn't make sense to us because we don't know what God knows. The illustration I always use, and I'm sure I've used it probably in this, is the idea of when I took Sheridan in for her like 4 month shots, and she got like 4 or 5 that day. And it's like she's getting 2 in this leg and 2 in this leg. And it's like, all right, Dad, Mom, let's hold her down. And I can still remember, that was 20 years ago now, and I can still remember her eyes when she got that first shot and she looked at me like, what are you letting them do? And just erupted in screaming, right? And I remember like getting teary-eyed. I'm like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. You know, But a four-month-old and a 25-year-old, I had a little bit more wisdom than her. I knew things that she didn't know. All she knew in that moment was, I'm hurting, make it stop. And why are you letting them do this? But I knew it was for her good. If you think about the wisdom between a four-month-old and a 25-year-old, how much more wisdom does a 30, 40, 50, 60, 70-year-old person and God? There's things he knows that we don't know. But it doesn't mean he's not sitting there saying, I know. I know. But that doesn't change the purpose. If I had stopped and said, no, don't give her any more shots because she's in pain. Don't give her any more shots. And maybe there's a time to do that, right? But I knew in that moment she was okay and it would only last for a short time. And I know that ultimately it was for her good. And I just think that's what our Heavenly Father does. I know. Trust me, if you knew what I knew, you would know that this is for your good. And that's what he can even do with evil and terrible things. He can say, I'm using this, but just wait till they see how I use it. And that's what he says, Job, is he says, can you do that? Just like Job can't make the sun rise and he can't make the sun set, he says, you don't have the power, you don't have the wisdom to do that. And just as God can bring in the daylight and bring in the nighttime, he can direct good and he can direct evil all according to his purpose. And so after taking Job deeper and deeper down, he now points Job up to the skies. Look at verse 22. He says, have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? So now, number four, we have the governance of God. The governance of God. In letter A, we have God's operation. So now he points him up to the sky, and he starts talking about precipitation. Still very natural illustrations. And he begins with the snow and the hail. Notice verse 22. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow or of the hail? And notice what this is for. I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. I think we think of snow as this beautiful thing. I talked about it last week. It can be very beautiful. But here he's talking about snow and hail as instruments of battle, instruments of tools of God to affect battle. Would be a better way of saying that. He uses these for judgment, for fighting for his people. Because in the plagues, one of the plagues was hail. God sent hail upon Egypt. That was one of the plagues. And then in the book of Joshua, there was hail to terrify the Amorites during a battle. And then snow, because of where it is, geographically, there wasn't exactly snow during a battle, but if we just think in war, if you go into a place where there's snow and cold, that changes the whole strategy, right? So snow and hail are there for God to fight for his people or to fight his battles. And so if we think about that, then notice what he asked Job. He says, have you entered into the storehouses where these things are stored? Which, of course, would be what? Somewhere in the heavens, right? In the clouds. And he says, have you been there? Have you seen it? Have you taken a tour? It's beautiful. Have you seen it? They're big. He says, have you entered it? These storehouses, verse 23, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. He says, have you seen the places where I store all this? And of course, again, the answer is no. Yahweh has a place for them that is stored and that he's ready to release from. He says, I've stored up in preparation for these things. I know the battles are coming. I know the times are coming that I need to send them out. And he says, I know when to send them out. I know where them are, where they are. He says, have you seen them? Have you seen them? Never mind, do you know when to release them? Have you seen them? And of course, the answer is no. But not only through snow and hail, Yahweh has a purpose, but also through the rain. Look at verse 25. He says, who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt? Let's see, through 27, sorry. Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? So let her be now. We have God's provision. So we have God's operation and then we have God's provision. So now he turns from a precipitation that was used for judgment and battle and war to now one of blessing. And so notice he says, this is Yahweh creating a cleft, a channel for the torrents of rain. So he can bring rain to one place and then direct it to another. I had no idea. This is just an aside, which I just thought was really cool. But when we went out to Yellowstone 2 years ago, the Continental Divide is out that far. Again, maybe I'm behind on this. But the Continental Divide is all the way out in Wyoming, so that if a drop fell there, and we had this like driving tour that was kind of explaining this, but I remember crossing the place where it said the Continental Divide. And they said, from this point, everything, every drop of water that falls here in Wyoming will end up going towards the Atlantic Ocean. I had no idea. It was that far out. I knew there was a Continental Divide, but I had no idea that it was that far out. But they said, from this point, everything will go towards the east and can eventually end up in the Atlantic Ocean. And that just blew my mind. And that's what he's kind of picturing here. So what he's saying is God can create this channel for rain in the rainy place and then a way to bring it to the desolate desert where even no man is. God has a way of doing that. Why? Because he created it. And he knows what needs water and what doesn't, and he can direct, if this place is getting a lot of water, I can make sure that I direct it to the places that need it, even a place where no man is, so that it will sprout grass. So there's this natural illustration here, but also it's the idea that God can direct his purposes and plans to the place that they need to go. Even to the farthest reach, even to the most desolate places. God will take care of his creation and he will take care of his people. God will be the one who moves things the way that he wants them to go. He can direct them. He can channel it to where he needs it to go. And so while humans are what God calls very good, he cares for his whole creation and seeks to provide for it all. And he will make a way that it will flourish. He says, where have you been? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain? Have you done that, Job? We're seeing the wisdom and knowledge of God and his control. And then verse 28, he continues with the rain. Who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heavens? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. So let her see now God's control. So not only can God direct the rain to the places that it needs to go. He says, now, who has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? Who created rain? Not only can God direct it, but who created it to begin with? And then who can make it freeze? Who can make frost? The waters, the sea, the oceans can become hard like stone and the face of the deep is frozen. The thing that you're most terrified of, God can make it frozen to where it's no more chaos because it's iced over. It's now hard like stone. And so this is all under his control, the sovereignty, the very hand of God who is intimately involved and interacts with his world. He's not far off. He's not distant. He's not just thrown everything, the chaos out there, and then said, let's just see how this goes. He is completely integrated, and he's working in it. He's active, working to both bring life and death, blessing and judgment. And that's what he's showing here. He says, not only is it cool that God can send the rain and he can send the hail and he can send the snow and he can create frost and he can make ice, but that he created the water drop itself. Because, again, if you think about the system of it, that water boils at exactly this temperature all the time. Now, granted, you can change that, right, with elements, and there's things you can do to manipulate that. But the water always boils here. The water always freezes here. The water is always at this temperature, otherwise, or at any other temperature, it's always water in between. That God created all that. He says, Job, you're sitting here complaining about the things of your life that you have no idea about. So all of this is in his control, and we're quick to ask God, why did this bad thing happen? Right? I mean, hopefully we'd all be honest to say, yeah, we do that. But the question I never seem to think about a lot of times is, God, why do you bless me? I don't ask that question. I'm not as amazed of just how much God blesses me and how much I don't deserve it as I am when I think I don't deserve suffering and struggles in my life. So that's what he's trying to show him. The one that's in control is the one who set all this up. Job, you couldn't have designed this. I did. You don't have the wisdom and the knowledge that you think you have. So if God can control even the very states of a drop of water, then he's in complete control of all aspects of this world. Look at verse 31. Can you bind the chains of Pleiades? Or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Or can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? So now he uses, these are constellations or heavenly bodies. The Orion, the bear, they are all constellations. The Maseroth is a Hebrew word that's transliterated. They're not sure if that's like the planets or if that's some other kind of constellation. They're not exactly sure, but it is this idea of heavenly bodies, stars, planets, things in the, you know, in space, in the galaxy. And here he asked them, are you the ones directing them where to go? That here the Lord is saying, even the very constellations in the sky are not by coincidence. That the reason that that's organized the way it is because that's the way God wanted it to be. He says, did you design the sky, Job? Did you lasso those to put those into place? Can you lead the planets around the sun? Of course, they didn't know what that meant at the time. I'm being an anachronistic here. But he does ask him, can you guide the constellations? Do you know the ordinances of heaven? Can you establish their rule on earth? He says, if you can't direct even one star in its place, which is in the sky, he He says, how can you know what's going on in heaven? Because the heavens would have been even further than the stars. Do you see that? He says, can you bind the chains or loose the cords? Do you know the ordinances of heaven? Can you establish their rule on earth? He's saying, if you can't control even one star, how do you think you can know what all is going on in heaven? That's a pretty powerful question there. Because we could even start smaller than that and say, if you can't control one drop of water to go to a desert, how could you know God's wisdom? How could you know God's control? How could you know God's power? See, this is all, again, in a loving way, showing Job, here's your place, Job. Don't get too big for your britches, as my grandmother used to say. He says, you have no control over them, but there's something even beyond the stars and the planets. And so here he's showing his governance and his control of even the seats of power on the earth. Because there's wisdom and knowledge from God, and he rules from heaven. And he's directing it all. He's in complete control. He's directing it all according to his purpose and his plans. That's the story of Scripture. There's human history as we know it, the timeline of history, right? The here and now, and everything that's happened up until now. But Scripture tells us that God is engaged and interacted and guided all things that are going to happen according to his purpose and plans. See, there's the timeline that we know, and then there's the things that God is doing that we don't always know. Question is, will we trust that he is working? That he's not lost control? That he hasn't taken his hand off of it? That we are all clay in the potter's hands? That's what he's trying to remind Job and us. But then he returns to water one more time for tonight. Look at verse 34. He says, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth a lightning that may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom, or who can tilt the water skins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods stick fast together? So letter D now, God's wisdom. So now he returns or continues kind of with this metaphor of water, and he now asks Job if he can call out the clouds and tell them what to do. Can you sit there, Job, and say, okay, clouds, I need you to rain? Can you call out to it and say, now I need you to lightning? I need you to thunder. I need you to send hail. I need you to send. Can you do that? But not only that, notice he says, Who can tilt, in verse 37, who can tilt the water skins of the heavens? It's that idea of the storehouses. Who can bring pitchers of rain? But notice we said God can use precipitation as a way of judgment and battle, and he can use it for blessing. And that's what he's showing here in this. Because notice again, he says, can you send forth lightnings, which is judgment, picture of judgment. But he says also, can you send rain? So what the Lord is saying here is, he says, you can't call down either one because you don't have the knowledge. You don't have the power. You don't have the wisdom, and you don't have the control. He says, who can do that? The Lord can. He says, I know when to send the lightning, and I know when to send the rain. I know when to send judgment, and I know when to send blessing. He says, you don't know, Job, He does. He does. It's all under his wisdom. And we have to come to terms with he knows what he's doing. I can remember telling Sheridan that sometimes when she would, just a typical kid, right, just questioning a lot of things. And I remember looking at her saying, Sheridan, I know what I'm doing. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. I think sometimes that's what God is telling Job here. Trust me, Job. I know what I'm doing. You don't know. And let's be honest. If Job ran the world, if you and I ran the world, it'd be a pretty big mess. Yahweh says, I know how to run this. Trust me. I know. And so Job here, as a man, is seeking to say there's no good reason for him to suffer. And Yahweh essentially lays out many ways to show Job doesn't have the wisdom and knowledge to even make that claim. And so here, as we kind of wrap up this evening, it's 7 o'clock, so I want to wrap this up. But what we see here is now the beginning of rhetorical. These are the rhetorical questions. This is the way that God kind of presents his argument to Job. Again, not to blast Job, not to demean him, but to teach him his place. The reason you're getting aggravated and so frustrated, Job, is yes, you're suffering, but you're worrying and making claims about things that you don't know. And so it would be easy for God to just say, Job, you're not in control. Shut up and stop acting like this. And he would have every reason to. But what's he doing? He's bringing Job in by talking to him and reminding him. Job, this is above you. This is bigger than you. But I care about you. And he's saying, I know. I know. But he doesn't want him to be focused on what he deserves, but rather, Pastor Brian said it so right this morning. And it's the thing that I remind people, I have to remind myself this, I have to remind, I remind other people this, but our theology goes off the minute we say, what about man? Our theology always starts with, first God. And see, that's what Job is stuck on here, is what about me, what about me, what about me? And God's like, no, 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 let's begin with me. Let's begin with Yahweh. And your theology will always go sideways if you don't begin with first God. And that's what God is trying to get Job back to here. And so in this first answer, we see that he has full control over the good, the bad, the joy, the sorrow, and the blessing and the judgment. And all of that is ultimately good because he's good. And he can use it for his purposes. And the cross is the ultimate example of that. The worst thing, the worst day in history, we would say, was for God's glory. And so we must remember this, because while we'll never go as low as Job, and certainly never as low as Jesus, we too do suffer and struggle. And we can be tempted to get into the what about me, what about me, what about me. And when we do that, we take our eyes off of Christ. But if we remember who's in control of it all, and that our Heavenly Father loves us, then we can hold on to the truth that he's never lost control, and that he'll bring glory and beauty from it in the end. And so here's what I wrote in my notes. If you take notes, this may be something you want to write down. But the only thing that can help you deal with a fallen world is trusting in an absolutely sovereign God. It's very similar to what Pastor Brian said this morning. But the only thing that can help you deal with a fallen world is trusting in an absolutely sovereign God. That's what keeps everything in balance. As we begin to steal that in our heart, doesn't make everything go away. It just gives us a foundation to stand on and trust each and every day for when these things come. It strengthens our heart and encourages our heart for today and every day forward. Let's pray.